Happy New Year, everyone. It's wonderful to be back with you here tonight. My name is Mitchell. I'm one of the pastors here at Village Church. And I just wanted to say I'm very grateful, very thankful to Sam, Pastor Sam, for holding down the fort last weekend so that me and Stephanie could get a little bit of rest and time off, which was really refreshing and lovely. But now I'm really excited to be back here with you tonight to worship God together, to enjoy His grace and His love toward us. I love the new year. It's just sort of this unbridled optimism that's sort of coursing through the air, and we have this opportunity to grab hold of it. So we're hoping that as we start this new series, we'll have the opportunity, the chance to do that. But the new year is also a time of max nostalgia and reflection in our home. And so just a few nights ago, my wife, Steph, and I, we found ourselves sitting on the couch going through old family photo albums. You know those things, physical photos with the, you know, sort of scrapbook style cuttings that Steph's granny put together for us. And when it's really fascinating going through those albums as you see all the sort of people, the family and the friends that pop up and make an appearance throughout your life as you grow up, all those people who slide so easily in and out of those pages, who've helped to shape us and mold us and really create the people that we are today. And as I started reading Paul's second letter to Timothy, I couldn't help but think of that as I was reading it, how it reads like a family photo album. But it's a family photo album with one major difference, that it's not just describing Timothy's biological family and the people that have sort of made and shaped him, but rather his faith family tree. And so you've got a Bible in front of you. You can see that there, how in verse 2, Paul calls Timothy his son, not because he fathered him, but because of their spiritual bond. Or how in verse 3, Paul, who had that powerful Damascus Road conversion, he doesn't look to that moment as the start of his faith, but he looks back at all of the faithful ancestors, all of those people in that who followed God faithfully down through the ages. Or how in verse 5, Timothy himself, he's the faithful recipient, not only of his mother Eunice's faith, but his grandmother Lois as well. All these people that form his faith family tree. And it makes you wonder about your own, doesn't it? Your own faith family tree. Think back on yours, the people and the pathway that have brought all of you here today, tonight. No matter where you come from or where you're going. Think about all of those people who have brought you here spiritually today in this moment. For me, when I think about my faith family tree, I think about my mom, who excitedly shared the gospel with me when I was a 9-year-old kid leaning against the fridge in our kitchen. Or I think about Danny McVeigh, the coolest English book I ever met, who in his early 20s took interest in me, a mere 12-year-old, when I was coming out of Sunday school and joining Big Church. Or most of all, I think about Aubrey Cron, my pastor back in Canada, back in that same church back in Canada. He was the one who stayed up late with me at night as I wrestled with my faith, the one who sort of prodded me along when I was going off track. He was the one to first invite me to do an internship at the church. He was the first one to suggest that I might have gifts suitable for pastoral ministry, the one who encouraged me to go to Bible college, in fact, the one who helped land me here in Brisbane at Queensland Theological College. And I remember the last time we went home to Canada, we surprised Aubrey at church, and when he saw me, he's this great big dude, he saw me, gives me this big bear hug, scoops me up off the ground, and says to everyone around him, "Everybody, this is Mitchell, he is like a son to me." It is a powerful thing, recalling your own faith family tree. Whether you've been a Christian your whole life, or whether you're here today exploring Christianity for the first time, that is wonderful to have you here. But take a moment to reflect on who got you here to this point today. And then just to spoil the surprise, where we want to be by the end of this talk is this. We want to be asking ourselves what it might look like for us to be that person for somebody else. That as we do head into a brand new year with new opportunities and goals and resolutions, wouldn't it be great to put this at the top of our New Year's resolution to continue your own faith family tree, to keep it growing, to pass on the gift of the gospel to somebody else this year? Because really, this is the crisis we find ourselves in as we open up Paul's letter. The crisis is that this guy, Timothy, he might be the last man standing in his own faith family tree, the final bloke to believe in the gospel in his generation. So as the story goes, Timothy, he's the leader of all the churches in Ephesus, and just a few months before this letter was written, there were lots and lots of Christians in Ephesus and in the surrounding area, the province of Asia, what we now call, or we now know as modern-day Turkey. And this is the area where Paul had the most successful missionary journeys took place in the province of Asia. And you can read about them for yourself in the book of Acts, and so we're thinking late 50s, early 60s AD. And lots happens in the province of Asia. And the city of Ephesus in particular is where Paul focused on the most. He spent about 2 or 3 years in this city building up the church in this strategic location, planting churches from here, sending churches out from here. This was like home base for him. A lot of progress, right? A lot of gospel fruit, lots and lots of Christians. But now, only a few years later, 2, 3, 4 years later, well, there might be only one Christian left. See that there in verse 15, Paul says, "You know that all those in the province of Asia have deserted me." They've deserted me. Now, doesn't mean that there's a bunch of people out there who simply agreed to disagree with Paul or couldn't quite handle his personality type. No, no, this is about turning away from the gospel that Paul first brought and turning away from his 2IC, from Timothy. Everything has fallen apart in only a few short years. So what happened? Why is that? Well, what happened is that on July 20th, Friday, July 20th, in 64 AD, a crisis hit the church. And in about maybe 2 or 3 years after Paul left Ephesus in 64 AD, the city of Rome burned down. And Emperor Nero, who was over Rome, cruel guy, just a not nice guy, needed a scapegoat, somebody to blame for the fires, and so he pinned it on the Christians. And as a result, the Christians began to be arrested. They began to be put to death. And Paul is arrested. And Paul reckons he's now facing death. And by about 65 AD, suddenly to be a Christian feels very different from when Paul first arrived with the gospel. Suddenly to be a Christian feels very dangerous. Suddenly to be one of Paul's Christians feels nearly suicidal. Verse 15 again, even Phygellus and Hermogenes have turned away. Now, we don't know who these fellows are, but you sort of catch the drift of the from the tone, don't you? These are the last two people on earth that you would think would ever abandon the Christian faith, and yet they do. I mean, just think about who that might be for you. Who's that person in your mind where you think, look, so long as they're following Jesus, so long as they remain faithful, I can keep going, I can make it through. And even they have thrown in the towel and walked away. And now Timothy is all that's left. Can you begin to feel it for Timothy? Do you get a bit of a sense of the pressure that he's facing? You got Paul in chains in prison. You've got Timothy, this last man standing, and he might be able to throw in the towel. He might be about to throw in the towel himself. In that 1 year, this one event, only 33 years after Jesus' resurrection, after the gospel mission began, you can see the vulnerability of the gospel. It might all be over in this one moment. And that is the pressure that Timothy is facing. But it's worth noting that this isn't an ancient historical problem, is it? Rather, this is an every generation problem. That is, no matter how on fire for the gospel this generation is, we are in this room, no matter how passionate or strong or zealous we are for the good news of Jesus, if we don't raise up new Christians, if we don't pass along this message, then, well, that's it. The gospel is always ever one generation away from extinction. And so 2 Timothy 1 asks us, what are we going to do in our generation with the gospel? Is it going to fizzle out by the year 2067 as one British writer recently suggested? Are we going to close our doors on the gospel? Or what would it take for the gospel to be destroyed in our generation? And then therefore, what are you willing to do to prevent that from happening? These are the questions going through Timothy's mind. So you got Paul crammed in a prison cell, a hole in the ground, and he's got one shot to turn this all around. Timothy, his last man standing, and Paul has as his silver bullet this. All he's got is this. He has this letter to do something about it. These words that are in front of us that could perhaps save the entire Gentile church from extinction. It's here. It's in this letter in front of us. So it might be worth paying attention to this letter for ourselves. Well, here's where Paul comes down on things in his letter. Basically, the whole heart of the book is around a very basic choice. There is one thing that could keep Timothy from keeping the gospel alive, one thing that could cause Timothy to give it all up and to throw in the towel, and it's this: it's shame. It's shame. Verse 8. Paul says, "Don't be ashamed of the testimony about our Lord or of me, his prisoner. Instead, share in suffering for the gospel, relying on the power of God." See, the whole heart of the book is around this very basic choice that Timothy needs to choose a side. You got shame and suffering for the gospel on one side, or, Timothy, you can give in to your fear, you can join everybody else and choose safety and comfort on the other side. And it's this choice between shame and comfort that creates, that forms the context of all of the commands that Paul gives, all the encouragement that Paul gives to Timothy in chapter 1. So let's chase through them quickly. If you've got a Bible in front of you, verse 6, Paul tells Timothy to rekindle the gift of God that's in you, this gift of faith, the gift of the gospel. Why? Is it so that Timothy can have a great personal spiritual experience? No. Fan into flame the gift of God that's in you, so that, verse 7, by the power of the Spirit, you won't be afraid. Afraid of what? Afraid of making the big choice of verse 8. Afraid to choose the gospel, to choose suffering for the gospel, relying on God's power. Okay, which one will you choose, Timothy? Shame and suffering for the gospel or comfort and safety? All you got to do is walk away. Just throw in the towel and walk away. Now, the curious thing is for us today that when we think about our own situation, we think about our own lives, it's actually not so different from us. That is, if there's anything that will keep our mouths shut when it comes to talking about Jesus with our friends, it's this. It's shame. It's the social cost that we might face for opening up our mouths, the social death we might experience, maybe even the risk of losing our job or at least our reputation or our status within our jobs, or to lose our friends or the families that we love if we speak up about Jesus. And I just want to point out, I think it's worth noticing that there are very real reasons for why we feel this way, very real reasons. So one of the most exciting books that I read last year is Sam Chan's book, Evangelism in a Skeptical World. And he talks about something unique and unusual that happened in Western history only a few hundred years ago that feeds into this problem. So a few hundred years ago, during the Enlightenment period, was when philosophers and thinkers began to divide knowledge, basically divide things that we know into two categories that eventually became known as the sacred-secular divide. Maybe you've heard this yourself before, the sacred-secular divide, okay? Now, the sacred realm involves topics like God and ethics and values, statements like there is a God, or gambling is wrong, or capitalism is better than socialism. You know, statements of value and worldview, that belonged in that category. But then on the other hand, the secular realm, you have, it's the realm of facts, okay? So evidence, hard evidence, data, statements like 1 + 1 = 2, the sky is blue. Okay, it's not working as well as I thought it would. Morning service killed it. You guys, not so much. Water boils at, yeah, it depends on where you are in elevation, I know. But anyway, the whole point wasn't to say that things in the sacred realm don't exist. That's not what they're saying. They don't say they don't exist. But simply put, as the argument goes, you just can't prove them. Whereas statements in the secular realm could. Now, doesn't mean these things aren't true. It just means that if we talk about them, we're going to have arguments. Because those who do believe that there is a God, or who do believe that gambling is wrong, or who do believe that capitalism is better than socialism, well, they can't prove it to those who don't. And so as a result, we've been conditioned in the West not to talk about sacred things in public. It's why you're taught, don't bring up religion and politics at a dinner party. But it's also why we generally only talk about secular things in everyday conversation. It's why our small talk is often so boring, because it's safe. Since these statements don't cause arguments, they are safe territory. Things like, gee, it's hot in this room right now, isn't it? Or things like, did you catch the game last night? Or things like, what do you do for work? This is safe territory for our conversations. But that's also why in the West we are told that we are free to believe anything we want about faith, about religion, about beliefs, so long as it's in the privacy of your own home. That nobody should dare impose their views of religion on others, at least in public. So it's like when I met our upstairs neighbor, and she found out that I was a pastor working at a church just up the road. And her immediate response was to, quite begrudgingly, because she did like us at this point, but throw up her hands and say, just as long as you keep that stuff to yourself, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Right? And this is why, this is the very real reason why so many of us feel so uncomfortable talking about Jesus with our friends. Because it cuts against the grain of everything we've been conditioned by, everything we've been trained to do, we've been taught to act, and what we believe is acceptable within our culture. But it's important to also realize that this isn't just an us problem, that our friends and family who aren't yet Christian, they also feel uncomfortable when we talk about Jesus with them. Because just like us, they also lack the language and the tools to be able to talk about such topics in public. And so a general rule of thumb when you're experiencing this in the real world is to think, is to remind yourself that if you are feeling confronted by somebody else's views, chances are they are feeling confronted by yours. Just remember that. So where we'll end this talk in a few minutes is I want to help by showing some ways, giving us some sort of tools and resources where we might be able to have those conversations about Jesus with our friends. Okay, but before we get there, for now, I want to show you how Paul himself deals with this issue with Timothy. That is, how does he help Tim overcome his shame, his fear of shame? It's actually quite brilliant, and yet it's so simple, and so I don't want you to miss it. How does Paul convince Timothy to rekindle his love for the gospel? It's by simply reminding him of that gospel. That's what's happening in verses 9 through to 12. So for example, verse 9, what did God do? Verse 9, he saved us, he called us, not because of our works, but because of his own purposes and grace. Not because of our works. Great thing to be reminded of at this time of the year, isn't it? You may have started your new year off strong. I mean, you kicked all your goals from last year. You're pretty stoked to set some new New Year's resolutions this year. Maybe the opposite. You woke up Jan 1st, you realize that you've dragged all of your hang-ups and all of your letdowns from 2019 into the new year. Maybe for some of you, we finished up here at Village just before Christmas, wrapped up our series in the Psalms, and you're feeling all warm and fuzzy in your heart for Jesus, and then you went back home for the holidays and began arguing with your family the first day you got there, and most of the days after that, right? Or maybe you, had a few, couple messy nights with old friends, fell into old habits. Maybe for some of us here, we didn't give God a second of our time or thought over the holidays. Well, isn't it great that the gospel says it's not about you? That God didn't call you because of who you are or what you could do for him. He's not impressed by your works. Rather, he chose you to love you because of his own purposes and his grace in your life. And when did he do this? When did he choose to love you? Verse 9 in Christ Jesus before time began. If you need some help putting two and two together, this was before the holidays when you may have made some of those stupid decisions, right? In other words, there's nothing you've said or done or will do or will say that will make God stop loving you because of Jesus. Now, that's pretty good news, isn't it? It gets better. Verse 10. We saw all of this happening when Jesus appeared. Now, that's Christmas time, by the way. It's what we just celebrated, the coming of Jesus into our world he created because he loved us so much. Loved us so much that he came to abolish death and bring life in its place. Again, such a timely message. Because as we look on helplessly, I mean, I don't know how you've been feeling over these last few days with the news of all the bushfires and the images across our screens. It feels so helpless to see all of this massive, tragic, senseless loss of human life and of plant life and of animal life. And we don't know what could possibly speak into such loss. Well, the gospel is all about abolishing death. That's the message. That Jesus, through dying and then getting up again, as if death by crucifixion was just a nap, by doing that, he destroys the grip of death, and so life wins. And if you believe in Jesus, your death too will be canceled out on the last day. But even now, Jesus comes to bring life, and not just to us, but to all of creation as well. He's making all things new, light out of darkness. Okay, says Timothy. Okay, let's say, Paul, let's say just for a second, I'm convinced this is a message worth saving. I won't give in to shame. I'll choose suffering for the gospel instead. Where do I go from here? What's your strategy, Paul? What's my next step? Paul's strategy is pretty clear. How do we keep the gospel alive? Verse 14, we guard it. We guard the gospel. So read along with me, starting in verse 13. This is Paul to Timothy. He says, "Hold on to the pattern of sound teaching that you've heard from me in the faith and love that are in Christ Jesus." Verse 14, guard the good deposit through the Holy Spirit who lives in us. The gospel, it's only ever one generation from extinction, and so it needs guarding. But what's the best way? How would you imagine the best way to guard the gospel is? You might, you know, picture taking the Bible and putting it into one of those big vaults locked away safely. You might think about retreating into the woods, right, to keep the gospel safe to ourselves. No, it's 2 Timothy. The answer is 2 Timothy 2, verse 1 and 2. The answer is we keep the gospel safe by passing it on to others. This brings us back to our own faith family tree and your part in it. And this actually brings us to the very center of our series for the summer. Watch how it works. 2 verse 1, Paul says to Timothy, therefore, so listen up, here's Paul's application for everything he's just said in chapter 1. You, therefore, my son, be strong in the grace that's in Christ Jesus. In verse 2, and what you've heard me say, pass it along to the next generation who will then pass it on to people after that, right? That is, committed to faithful men, faithful women, he'll be able to do the same for others. You want to guard the gospel, Paul says? Then give it away. The gospel, it's the only kind of treasure that you guard by giving it away. So to summarize, you've got Paul, he's in prison. He knows he's not getting out of this one, knows his life is coming to an end, and so he punts the ball over to Timothy so that the gospel is with the next generation who passes it on to somebody else, who passed it along to somebody else, who passed it along to somebody else, who passed it along to somebody else, to someone else, to someone else, to someone else, to the person who told me the gospel, told you the gospel. Now it's your turn to pass it along. Which means that this gospel message, it'll never die, no matter what the crisis is, so long as we keep passing it along. Okay, so now here's where we get to the pointy end of the talk for ourselves today. That is, how can we talk to our friends about Jesus? How do we pass it along, pass along the gospel? Sort of what tools or strategies are there? Well, how can we keep our own faith family tree growing? That's what we'll look at now as we finish. There are two strategies. you can start using in your own life to help pass along the gospel. And again, here I'm channeling Sam Chan. What are those two strategies? Well, the first step is we want to listen well to their story. We want to listen to their story. And number two, we want to tell our story as story. Okay, number one, we want to listen to their story. And number two, we want to tell our story as story. Let's take a look at those two things. The first one there, our first strategy for passing on the gospel, number one is listen to their story. So instead of worrying about what we will say or about trying to have all the right answers or knowing what to say in the moment, we let them begin the conversation about faith, religion, and belief. And this will really help us understand where they are coming from. And if we have listened really well to them, that is, listening with respect, with empathy, with understanding, then hopefully, when it is our turn to talk, they'll do the same for us. And we get there, we get to listening to their stories, by looking for opportunities to move the conversation from the secular into the sacred. So for me, what often happens is, as I already flagged before, I might be meeting somebody new for the first time, and it eventually comes up that what I do for work is I am a pastor, and I work for a church just up the road over in QUT in Kelvin Grove, and ba-bow, instant conversation killer. That's it. They sort of look past it. Oh, sorry, I think someone's calling me, you know. Why is that? Why does that happen? Well, it happens because the conversation was safely in safe territory, wasn't it? It was in the secular. What do you do for work? That is safe territory, but now I have dragged it into the sacred. Before they were ready for it, I've dragged them into church and religion and God, and now we're both feeling a little bit awkward. But it doesn't always have to be that way. Sometimes, actually, people find out I'm a pastor, and they say something like, or they're surprised why somebody like me, and I'm still trying to work out what that means, but why somebody like me would decide to do that sort of work. Or even at a more base level, why would someone like me choose to be a Christian? And in those moments, we can actually use this opportunity to give them permission to stay in the sacred. And so you can ask them something like, well, do you have a faith? Right? Do you have a faith? Or Steph's favorite question to ask someone is, what's your experience of church been like? And if they change the subject, it means they don't want to talk about sacred things right now. That's totally fine. It's fine if they change the subject. But if they do want to talk, you are giving them permission to do so. And when we ask them if they have a faith, and they say something like, I am a Buddhist, then our next step is to be genuinely interested in what they say. Ask them questions like, how did you become a Buddhist? Did you grow up in a Buddhist family? What does that look like? How do you worship? What's it like being a Buddhist in Australia? And if they say that they're an atheist, like, we can be just as interested because atheism, like any other worldview or any other religion, is a faith-based position. So we can ask them similar questions. Questions like, how did you become an atheist? Did you grow up in an atheist family? Who are your favorite authors? What's it like being an atheist in Australia? And the aim here is to listen, it's to understand, it's to empathize. Okay, so you got to kill that urge to interrupt them. Don't think about how you might be able to interact with their position. And please, if you can just do one thing, do not assume that you know what their faith or religion or belief believes. Okay? Instead, you ask as many questions as possible so that you can properly hear what they're saying. You can genuinely understand them. You can try to feel what they're feeling to see the world from their point of view. So, for example, last weekend I was getting my hair cut. Thanks for noticing. And I know you're all thinking it. And new barber, so first time meeting him. And as it always goes, he finds out that I'm a pastor. And his first response is, oh, my mom is devoutly religious. My mom's religious. So I asked him, well, how did that play out for you and your family? And he said, myself, I'm not so much religious myself, but I'm definitely not atheist. I would probably say I'm more agnostic. oh, that's interesting. So I asked him if he ever went along to church with his mom, just trying to understand where this sense of being agnostic came from. You ever go along to church with your mom? What's your experience of church been like? Oh, no, not really. A few times as a kid growing up. But I was really curious where this came from. And so I said, well, have you had any sort of experience with Christianity? What's sort of been your touch point with Christianity? And he goes, oh, well, I went to a Christian school. Oh, well, fantastic. What was that like for you? Was it a good experience, bad experience? No, it wasn't great, he said. Wasn't a great experience. Oh, what happened? The principal had an affair with the science teacher, and it kind of messed me up a little bit in my thoughts and views about it all. It's why I'm not totally closed off to the idea, he says, but I'm certainly skeptical. I have a lot of questions about it. Now, that's naturally where the conversation wrapped up. When you're getting your hair cut, it's a pretty tight, pretty defined time frame anyway. But had I not been curious about why he describes himself, identifies as agnostic, I never would have discovered that he's got real, genuine questions about the Christian faith, questions that perhaps could be explored if he wanted to, if he chose to do that. In fact, that might be a really great place to start next time I get into the chair if I were to see him again. Okay, so that's the first step in how we might be able to talk to our friends about Jesus, is that we just want to listen well. We want to listen to their stories and look for those opportunities to keep the conversation in the sacred. Okay, but now for the scary part. What happens when it's our turn to talk? What can we do when it's our turn? Well, the last thing that we'll look at for today, number two, is we want to tell our story as story. I'll explain what I mean by that. I want to put it to you guys that when it comes to sharing the gospel, when it comes to talking about faith, you have an incredibly powerful tool at your disposal. And it's this, it's your story, it's your personal story, your own experience of faith and life. And when it's our turn to talk, you can say something like, would you like to hear why I'm a Christian? We can give what is known in Christian jargon, in Christianese, as our testimony. But the key to deliver our testimony is we want to deliver our story as a story. That is, a good story, here's what I mean by that, a good story has two things. It has events that have happened to us, and it has a storytelling grid by which we can arrange those events, okay? So, sorry if you're on break from writing essays, but think about something like an introduction, a body, and a conclusion. Well, actually, we don't have to think about school. We can think about our favorite films. Think about a classic rom-com, right? Follows this same structure. So in your classic rom-com, boy meets girl, and in that moment, we are presented with their mission to fall in love with each other. And as the story unfolds in the body, they become more and more romantically involved. But then, crisis hits. Boy loses girl. And all that has happened up until now is summarized in a musical montage. And then the boy, he's got that aha moment where he realizes what a fool he's been, and he recommits to the mission to fall in love with the girl. And in the climax, the boy, he makes a move to declare his love for the girl, and she accepts, and the two finally commit to each other. And in the closing scene, we're given a glimpse into their new normal world as a couple. Roll credits. Now, the interesting thing is we can use that very same storytelling grid to tell our own story of faith. If you don't believe me, you're looking a little bit doubtful, let me give you an example. In the introduction, we introduce ourselves. We establish the character, who we are, what drives us, what's our mission, what are we living for, who am I, and what is my mission? And then in the body of the story, we show examples of how we've tried to achieve this mission without God. Now, maybe that was before you became a Christian, depending on your story. Or maybe that was trying to achieve your mission without God as the goal of that mission. But anyway, at the bridge, we present the aha moment where we realize what a fool we've been. It's Jesus we've been looking for all along, and we explain who Jesus is and what he's done for us. And in the climax, we give our lives to Christ, right? We declare our love for him. Now, this can be a gradual sense of awareness or a sudden moment, depending on your own story. But now that we've given our lives to Christ, we have found God's answer to our mission. Jesus satisfies our God-given drive. And in the closing scene, we give an example of what our new life looks like. This is our new normal. Now, what I'm going to do in a second is I'm going to close by giving you an example of this from my own life. I'll tell my own story as story. But as I'm sharing, I want you guys to be thinking about what this might look like for you. How could you give your own testimony as story? And as we start a new year, it'd be really worth thinking this through, maybe with some friends or on your own. And just in case you ever get that opportunity this year to somebody asks you, why do you believe in Jesus? Why are you a Christian? And you might be able to say to them, well, can I tell you a story? Can I tell you why I'm a Christian? You might be able to share with them your story as story. Okay, but using my using this outline, this storytelling outline, my own testimony could sound something like this. I was born into a farming family on the prairies of Canada, and I've always defined myself by who I am in relation to others. And so my mission in life was to find the perfect relationship. For example, even though I had no natural skills in the field, I spent my entire teen years training to take over the family farm because I wanted to please my dad and honor my family. But that didn't work out. And so I tried to achieve my mission by pursuing the ultimate relationship, marriage. For example, I ended up proposing to my first girlfriend despite how very young we were. But the problem with pursuing the perfect relationship is that it doesn't exist. If you define yourself in relation to others, you'll constantly be let down because we're all flawed and broken ourselves. For example, I ended up calling off that first engagement and really hurting somebody else in the process. And even now, as a married man, I still cause hurt and still experience pain because nobody's perfect. No relationship is perfect. We'll accept Jesus and the relationship that he wants to have with us. You see, I'd grown up in a Christian family. I had known Jesus all my life, but the depth of his love for me never really clicked until someone opened up the Bible and explained to me how the death and resurrection of Jesus was God's way of showing me that he has done everything there was to do in order to have a relationship with me. That the greatest display of love is that someone might lay down their life for their friend, and Jesus calls me his friend. And that's when I realized that if I had Jesus' love, I had everything I needed. I didn't have to find the perfect relationship because God had already given me his perfect love in his son, Jesus. Instead, if I had Jesus, I could have a rock-solid identity that didn't slide so easily between people's opinions of me. And so now I no longer chase the perfect relationship in order to define who I am. For example, although friendships are still incredibly important to me, I can view them for what they are, a gift from God to be enjoyed, not controlled. And in my own marriage, I don't have to feel devastated whenever we let each other down because I no longer look to this relationship to satisfy all my longings. As another pastor once put it, Jesus is the only one in the world who, if you gain him, will satisfy you, and if you fail him, will forgive you. And that's why I continue to follow Jesus. Let's pray.